No, all right.
Blog Talk Radio.
I took a nap. What can I do?
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a boat, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. Day Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when live and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is MJ Network. MJ in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who started me off on this crusade. And I am so excited. I hope I pronounced your name the right way. It's Frank Escalise. Is that the right way to pronounce your last name, I hope?
And that is perfect.
I'm very good. See, I got that right. And Vincent Andrea is here, and we're going to talk about a whole bunch of stuff. So good morning, guys. I am so excited.
Morning, Frank.
And
morning, Frank.
Good morning, good afternoon, I think. I've been up since 11 o'clock reading. What can I say? the pile's huge, and the books are... not yours. That's so sad, really. So, Frank, give everybody some of your background, and then we're going to talk about the anthology that you created and how a person gets involved in becoming part of the anthology. That sounds like fun.
Well, I was a police officer for 20 years in Spokane, Washington. Retired in 2013 as a captain.
Nice.
And but I've been writing my whole life, and I started really getting published in 2004, first book in 2006. So for a while I was a writer and a police officer, and now I'm just a writer. I write mostly crime fiction, and mostly under the pen name Frank Zaffiro. And I'm kind of all over the genre map in crime fiction. Write a couple of procedural series, you know, PI series. Hard-boiled, you know, darker stuff. No cozy, but outside of that,
oh good.
That's pretty much the whole waterfront there.
So how come I never got them to read? Because Vince writes scary stuff, and I have to have the lights on when I read his book, and I have to make sure that somebody's there seriously, because I never know what he's going to write. It scares the jam, but it's so good though. Then I just sit down and read it, and then I have the nightmares for 3 days, and that's perfect. So I never got any of your books to read. And then I didn't know about you because I would have included him in our crazy panels that we're going to do very recently. So how do you decide on a topic for an anthology? I got picked to you on one about a million years ago, but how do you get to decide what the topic is and the theme?
You know, for a regular anthology, you know, a collection of short stories in a single volume, you know, classic anthology set up, my experience has been is it usually starts with just a germ of an idea, a what if or a premise. My friend Colin Conway recently published an anthology called The Eviction of Hope, and he centered it around the idea of an apartment complex called the Hope Apartments, and everybody's getting kicked out. They got a 6-month window to get their business done. They got to get out of the apartments. And each individual story would be about one of the tenants. And so they're loosely linked and there's some crossover, but there's plenty of room for the writer to tell whatever story that the writer wants to tell. And so I think it generally happens that way. A Grifter Song is a little different in that it's a serial anthology of novella length. So 10 to 30,000 words. And it's episodic in that every story stands alone, but it's the same characters, and they do have their history. And so there's a meta arc, a series arc that's happening at the same time as these individual stories.
That's so interesting because, I've read too many anthologies. No, really, I read too many things. Vince knows I read a lot of stuff. And
I'm actually reading the Grifter series now, and it's terrific.
Really?
Yeah,
I just read one, and I won't tell you what the name of it is because They're going to be on my show next week, and oh God, my poor me. The stories are really interesting. They're about something, but when I went to give the person the question, she said, "Well, can I rearrange the order in this way or that way?" I go like, "Sure, drive me crazy before I even start." So yeah. So if you're going to write a story that's going to have villains, you and Vince create villains that are the same or different. Because Vince, your villains are my favorites because they scare me. I don't know how you create them and make them so evil, which is probably becoming my new personality lately. Seriously.
Well, I've said this before. A lot of my villains are my friends. So I use them as models.
I want to be the teacher in the novel. I've always been the good one. I want to be the rotten person just once.
Oh, I have to get you in there, friend. I'll get you in there on one of these.
I have to be.
Make
so,
an evil
the
villain.
I know, I did. The Karen Vaughn made me Francesca Luciano, whatever the heck it was. And I was a publisher, and I stole somebody's ideas, and I got away with it at the end, sort of. So I said that Francesca wasn't evil enough. So Marcia told me she listens to your podcast on YouTube. What topics do you focus on? Because I can't listen to things on my phone. It bothers my eyes. But sometimes I just listen and don't look at the stuff. But what are your podcasts about? Because Frank does them also.
Right. Yeah. And Frank's way ahead of me. I mean, Frank, your podcast is so slick. It's really great. But I started mine in I think May, just before I went away, and I just had this idea that like instead of like doing a podcast about where I interview other writers or because that's already being done well by like Frank. What I wanted to do was something that is strictly about the writer's life, not how to write. You know what I mean? I'm not gonna tell you how to write. I'm not gonna tell you how to write a novel. I'm not gonna tell you how to write a short story. Or I'm leaving that up to other people. But I want people to know what a real writer's life is like. So like whether it's just me, my daily activities, or whether it's my travels, whether it's relationships, anything that has to do with my writer's life is fair game.
Yeah, but that's so interesting. It's not as boring as some of the topics that I've been getting, like why do you write this, and I don't really care. Have you noticed that when I go and I ask somebody about a book, I will never say to them, how come you wrote it, because I don't really care. Or why did you become a writer? Because you are. The boring stuff, I get yelled at, like, well, how come you ask those questions? Because nobody wants to look at the boring. You want to know something different and something that matters. Yeah.
Right. My point was, like, I want, because readers, they're going to read my stuff, but they're like, who is this guy? You know, and, like, I want people to really have an idea who the author is. I want to take them along on adventures and stuff like that. And then hopefully they'll be like, well, I kind of like the writer, so therefore if I like the writer, maybe I'll look more into his work.
Well, they should read all of your work because it's what I love is that nothing's the same. And you never write the same
thing. I know.
That's
a blessing and a curse. That's a blessing and a curse, believe me.
Well, I'll tell you what. I got some really nasty reviews on Population Zero because people didn't realize why I wrote it. And I said, maybe I really did a better job. Yeah, there were some people on Goodreads that gave me bad reviews, but they didn't read the book. They just rated it for no reason. And I just
they control.
You know what? I don't care because it didn't matter. But all I know is that I've been getting an awful lot of reviews on Goodreads from people I don't know that just downloaded the PDF of all sorts of stuff. And I just ignore it because you have to have it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter.
Right.
Because I know I'm great. That's all that really
matters. It counts.
Not really. I as soon as I get as good as one of you, the two of you, then maybe I'll be okay. But yeah, I'm going to do another Faces Behind the Stones. I have an idea, but I have to have 10 minutes to write it. So how do you incorporate your professional life as a police officer, as a cop, in your novel? And do you have a main character in any of them? Is there a series that I haven't read, and why haven't I read it? Seriously.
Well, the second question is yes. I'd say that the River City series is my flagship series.
Nice.
It's the first few books were in that series before I branched out, and then I continued to write in that series. And it was set up more as an ensemble cast. So think like Hill Street Blues or NYPD Blue or, you know, something like this where there's, you know, multiple characters and you get to experience, you know, everything that they're going through, and the storylines follow different characters at different times. But it didn't work out as well as I had hoped in that, or actually I should say it worked out better than I hoped, because a central character kind of did emerge. And so for me, the core of the series has become Officer Katie McLeod, because she kind of incorporates this or encompasses this idea of the humanity of the police officer, which was something I was really striving for, something that I wanted to show more than just a cliche, more than just a badge or a uniform, you know, the person behind it. And so she experiences, you know, the doubts, the fears, that an officer might experience in different situations, and yet she doesn't quit. She keeps on, and so she has that tenacity and that idea of service that is so common in the profession as well. And so because she does such a good job of showing that, I end up pushing her to center stage pretty regularly. I'd say she's more than a first among equals. She's definitely, if this was a TV show, she'd be getting top billing.
Well, that's interesting, because I just read, and I won't say the title of the book, that I have to interview the person in December, about a police officer, and I just kept trying to say, if you're given the job of being the head of a murder investigation, get some spunk. You know, like, don't back out, back down. Don't worry about what the guys think. If you're in charge, you need to be in charge. And that bothered me, because I was like, all through the book, I wanted to smack her in the head, like, wake up, it's going to be okay. And that's the hard part, because how do male deal with a female person in charge? Let's say that she was the captain.
Well, it's different, I think, now than it maybe used to be, but it is a male. It is still a male-dominated profession in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that Katie deals with, is being a female in a male-dominated profession, and it is a profession where, you know, you ask how I incorporate, you know, having been a professional. Well, one of the ways is bringing cultural aspects of the job into the stories. And here's a prime example. You know, everybody, when they come on the job, they have to prove themselves. Doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you were, you know, a major league baseball prospect who blew out their knee to the point where they can't play sports anymore, but they can still be on the job. That guy has to prove himself, and so does every other, Tom, Jane, and Mary. Well, unfortunately, at least in the past, if you were a female officer, you not only had to prove yourself as an officer, but you had to kind of get over the fact or get past the fact that you were a female officer. So you almost had to double prove yourself. And maybe the proving process took a little longer. Like you might be able to prove yourself with one good event, how you handled a particular situation or a case. People might be go, oh, kid's fine. Kid can handle it. If you're a female officer, maybe it's like, huh, that went well. I wonder if she can handle it. And then you maybe have to do it again or maybe three times before people buy in to that. And so Katie dealt with that for quite a while as she was cementing her reputation. And that is an element, or was an element, of law enforcement. I think that's changed significantly, although I doubt it's gone away entirely.
If I can interject real quick, I can totally back up what Frank is saying, because I did a colonel in the state troopers, and who started in the 80s. In the 80s, it was extremely different. It was just like Frank was saying, you know, from what she's told me, you know, you had to prove some, like, you're like one woman out of like 100 men. And then things started changing a little bit in the 90s, then a little bit in the 2000s. And now I think that she's going to be like the subject of a video on how, like, she literally went from being like a cook in a diner after college to like one of the top female law enforcement officers in New York State. So what Frank is saying is spot on. And Frank, I have one for you too. How do you do it? How do you read fiction like mine and be like, this wouldn't happen? You must be like, you must have to sometimes shut off your professional police filter just to let the fiction do its work for you.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, you always try to watch a show or read a book or whatever, as a viewer who wants to enjoy the story. And so if small details are wrong, most of those I just breeze right over, unless it's a key plot point, like that everything is hinging on this and it's completely wrong. That can irritate me. It's more pet peeves that get to me. I don't know why. The two that seem to bother me the most are when people just completely get rank structure wrong. And I don't mean a little bit wrong, but like totally wrong. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one, though, is when you see a patrol officer especially, but even a detective, arrive on scene or get into a situation that's going to be a gunfight potentially, and they take their weapon out and they rack the slide. That just kills me every time. I'm like, so you're riding around with an empty gun, basically. I don't know a cop in the country. I don't know a cop that's done that since basically Wyatt Earp, when it was dangerous to have the hammer resting on a cartridge.
You are so absolutely right, because my friend keeps a round in the chamber.
Yeah. What about the violence on these programs that they, I watch Criminal Minds. My husband's addicted to it. And some of that, they can't possibly, when they go and they get somebody, the suspect in, and the suspect says something and they beat the crap out of them. You're not supposed to do that, are you? I mean, it's like, what? They're not supposed to, and they're getting away with it. It makes it seem as if that's what police officers do, and I don't think so.
That's not
the norm, is it?
Nope.
No, not at all. And in fact, if the stuff they don't show, when they show things like that on shows or TV shows or movies or even in the books, what they don't tend to show is the fallout from that. So, the officer, the detective smacked somebody around and they got information. But what you don't see is that if that person was a witness, now they're filing a complaint against the guy and he's going to get fired or even arrested and thrown in jail for assault, essentially. Or they don't show, if the guy was the suspect, that he challenges the admission and it gets disallowed by the judge and the whole case falls apart. They don't show the fallout for these reckless actions that are illegal. But it's fiction, right? I mean, it's fiction and people want to be entertained. And so, I'm not knocking on it as a literary device, if you will, because I've employed it at times. I try to write a series that is grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. Now it's, pumped up fiction version of reality. I mean, there's no way all the things that have happened to Katie McLeod would happen to one officer. Mm-hmm. It's almost unheard of. But every single thing that happened to her, it could happen to an officer. And the way that it happens tends to be realistic. And I try to include the fallout of events, whether they did something wrong or not, because everybody knows in this world you can do everything right and still get sued.
Mm-hmm.
This is so true. But you know what? It's not just police officers. Every morning there's construction up here. Con Ed has taken over the world. You could barely travel after 9 o'clock in the morning. They have you could literally, you have to, and I feel so bad because this poor girl is standing there for the last 2 months with a pole in her hand saying, slow or stop. And I look at her and I go like, you poor thing, they haven't gotten her to do anything better than slow and stop. And I just said, like, she wants to be a construction worker. I don't even talk to her. And she's so pretty. It's like, she's like, just there. And it bothers me because basically I'm sure she's got more intelligence than just to stand there and go slow. I mean, really. And I wondered one of these days, I said I was going to come out and say to her, you're the reason why there are no accidents, because you're standing here and making sure nobody gets hurt. But I don't think she realizes that. That's scary.
Take it from an old construction worker. She's making bank, Brent.
I know she is. what can I say? I won't tell you what I made. The first year that I taught, I made $5,710, and I thought that was a fortune. really. And but yeah, it was like nothing. And my mother
sounds like writer's royalties.
Yeah, so please, royalties.
In a good year.
Actually, that's funny because I did get royalties from my last, from the new one. But Amazon takes it all. That was the other thing. I mean, I sold 250 copies of Population Zero. The royalties should have been close to 2,000, and I got 512. I was like,
oh, that's
ridiculous. Yeah, I know, because it's Ingram and all the rest of that, and they get it all. And I don't even know. You can't even tell if you're getting gypped. So this is another question in my thing here. when you put on the podcast, anyone, what kind of response do you get from people? And do they ever say to you, "I wish you would do one on this," or "I wish I would do one on that topic"? Do they ever anybody suggest anything besides what you know? A writer's life is interesting because I know people think you're loaded when you make have a novel. Then everybody's not James Patterson.
Right. Right.
So
sometimes I'll get I've been getting a lot of mail lately, people 2 and 3 page long emails about I started a novel, I started this novel, and then I quit it halfway through, and then I started another one, and I started this one, and I'm working, and I have kids, and it goes on and on and on. And, so how do I finish it, you know? I get a lot of stuff like that, and the simplest answer is just sit down and finish one project, you know, and then go on to the next one or whatever, things like that. But as for me, I know, Frank, you probably get a lot more requests for shows, but for me, I literally sometimes I'll just – go on the air, and I have no idea what I'm going to say, and it just comes out, and it's that's just the way it is. And other times, if I'm away, if I'm overseas or something like that, I'll want to go to a specific place to have as a backdrop, and I'll talk, and that also provides something interesting about the writer's life in itself, you know, so. You know, for instance, I'll be in Rome in a couple of weeks, and I'll do a video in front of the Colosseum, and that in itself will
nice.
Be interesting, I think. Yeah.
But do you ever ask people to join you that are in the country? Do they ever come on the video with you and talk about
it, or
you just do it yourself?
Right now, it's just me because I don't have the technological skill to bring on a guest, but eventually I will, for sure.
That's
the contacts I get is people sending messages that want to be on the show. I don't get the kind of 2 or 3 page letters that Vincent gets. I will say that I have a small but loyal following, and I'm only discovering that sometimes because a lot of them are authors, and I'll have somebody on the show, and we'll finish recording, and they'll be like, "Hey, thanks for having me on. I've been listening for a while, and I really like the show, and I particularly like this episode." You know, they tell you things that make it clear it's not just gin music; they're serious, and that's pretty gratifying because the whole reason I started Wrong Place, Right Crime was to promote authors. I mean, Vincent's been on the show.
Great, thank
other,
you.
Yeah, I mean it's the whole point is to promote other authors, and the benefit I get out of it is that networking piece. I mean, I've met a lot of people I may not have otherwise met, but it feels good. It's like what you're doing here today, right? I mean, you're providing a service, a benefit to both Vincent and I, and it feels good. It feels good to push other people and to be supportive. And let's face it, even before COVID, I spent a couple of years living a hermit's life, and so the podcast has been a pretty good social outlet as well.
Right. Exactly.
No, I love doing this. It's a lot of fun, but I get emails from publicists. I have a book for you. I mailed it. They mailed it even before they asked me if I want it. I don't know how they figure out where. And when would you like the interview with the author? And I usually say, after I read the book and see if I want to promote the author. I have to read it to know that it's something that I want to put my name on. and a book that I want to, you know, spotlight. And I think in the, I don't even know how many years I've been doing it, I think only twice I said I wouldn't interview the author because I felt the book disagreed with my point of view and I really didn't think it had a message that I wanted to bring out. That's rare.
Fran, you get some major, major, major league authors and publishers calling you.
Yep, I do.
Well,
I had Robert Cicogni 2 weeks ago. If you haven't read While the World Played Chess, it was a phenomenal interview and it's a phenomenal book. Yeah, and I'm on the list, but I'm very disappointed. I'm on the list for John Grisham's new one, The Judge's List, and I read some of his reviews, and I emailed the publicist. I said, you should really encourage him to do an interview with me. It might help. That's all I said.
Sure.
And he said, yeah, well, what can I say? You can't have everything. But I do. I get the major authors. I've got Vincent Zandri.
Yeah, right.
And I've got a whole bunch, and I've got a spam phone call, and then they can go stick a sock in it. I can't stand these baloney phone calls I get, yeah. No, I've gotten Tess Gerrinson and Gary Brava and Iris Johansson. As a matter of fact, Tess Gerrinson is the first New York Times author that I emailed all by myself and asked her if she would be on my show. And then when she said yes, I was like, oh, my God, she actually said yes, yeah. So,
that's great.
It's a lot. This is so much fun. And the reason is also because of this dumb pandemic that doesn't want to go away, I think people have forgot how to be nice. And I think that
right. They
forgot that there are other things in the world besides this horrible monster. So, Vince, you create fear and unique plots, and I'm trying to figure out one for my next craziness, but how do you decide on what to write about? I mean, every character is so scary. So you've got Desperate Measures. When am I getting that, by the way? I just have to put you in my schedule.
I know. I have to get some author copies, and they're coming. They're coming. And when I get them, I'll send you one for sure. That one's my own company, Bear Media. So I need an assistant, Fran. That's what I need. I need an assistant. I got to call the university and see if somebody wants to intern. And there's got to be, like, some English major or writer that would intern. You know, so I'm going to do that. But to answer your question, I always give you the same answer. It like just sort of, I just write in the dark. It just sort of, you know, I have like sometimes I'll just come up with a title like The Teacher, for instance. Mm-hmm. Like I'm working on that's the new Moonlight. And then as I started writing, I'm like, oh, you know, there was an incident that happened in the Albany area about 10 years ago where a really mm-hmm. attractive female teacher started sleeping with her students. And this is a Catholic boys' school, right? Prestigious private Catholic boys' school. And she was, and this I knew this woman actually. And irony of ironies, I actually applied for the job that she got at the school. And like, I couldn't believe it because I was like, okay, here, I have an MFA and two books published by a major publisher, short stories, whatever, and they rejected me and took this person on who had zero credentials and ends up sleeping with some of the kids, and it makes international headlines and all this sort of stuff. And so, you know, okay, boom, I have this plot. But I fictionalize it to the extent that, like, it's almost completely different from the real story, you know.
Well, all we had in my school after a million years, we did have a pedophile. We did. And what the funny part was, it wasn't funny, is that he was one of the top disciplinarians. And I don't know, I came into his classroom because I didn't have a computer. And he made all the girls hug him at the end of the day. And I said, that's inappropriate behavior.
Yeah.
The next day, I walk into the, and I told the principal, well, she's a complete idiot, she's still there. And I said, you know, he's doing things that he shouldn't do. And then the next day they arrested him because he, two boys, and they wound up with AIDS, the kids, too, because of him. Because he was HIV positive. And he spent 10 years in Rikers. And then they had the gall to ask me if I was going to defend him. I go, yeah, okay, right, next question. So you just don't know. That would be an interesting story, though. So the other thing that's the hardest part is to get marketing. How do you get your publishing company to market? Because Population Zero was independently published. You don't, and they did nothing. I paid a lot of money to get the book published, and then they said, for $4,000, we'll market it for you. I said, for $110, I got Karen Bourne doing it for me every week, and she's fantastic, and it's going somewhere. So, I mean,
yeah,
seriously.
So
what do you do? How do you get people? Well, you guys have no problem. Me, it's like, who is that little blonde thing with the crazy color hair? So how do you market the books, and how do you get people to want to read them?
Frank, you go first, buddy.
Well, that's the trick, right? I mean, it used to be that the hardest part for the writer was getting past the gatekeepers, right? It's hard to get an agent. It's hard to get into, get published, and that was so everybody was banging at the castle gate trying to get in. Then, self-publishing and it came along and morphed into independent publishing, and suddenly, the castle walls were down, and so everybody's inside, the keep, and then the problem became one of not necessarily finding a publisher or an agent, but getting readers' eyes on your work, being heard, being discovered, being seen. And a buddy of mine, another writer, we've talked about this frequently, and one of the analogies that came out of it is we all feel like, as writers, we're at a rock concert. We're all the smaller writers. We're out in the audience, and the James Pattersons and the Stephen Kings are up on stage, and we're out there kind of, trying to shout at this rock concert to be heard. It's tough. And for a long time, I didn't really do anything outside of some social media posts and so forth. And certainly the publisher I was with didn't do anything at all beyond a couple of very simple things like, put out a press release when the book comes out. That's about it. And so that was one of the reasons why I decided to go fully independent. And so about 95% of my work right now is independent. I have a publishing umbrella, and I do it all myself. And I've looked into and studied how are the people who are selling a lot of books doing that, and tried to emulate it. And it really comes down to that old adage, you've got to spend money to make money. You have to advertise. Of course, advertising effectively, that's a whole hour long conversation just to crack the surface.
Right.
But that's what you got to do. You got to, for the average reader out there to hear about Frank Zaffiro or Vincent Zandri, we've got to work to get it in front of them. Now, obviously, you have to have a quality piece of product. You have to have a good book, or maybe you get eyeballs on it and they crack the book, they read a paragraph and puke, and all your work is for nothing. So having a good book is the number one thing, but you have to have a good cover. And then you have to do some absorb about advertising to, get it in front of the readers. And I'm confident with, myself and a lot of my friends and colleagues that I'm aware of, Vincent's a good example, where the quality of the writing, the storytelling is not a problem. It's good. Sometimes it's great. The hardest part is getting somebody to look at it in the first place. And then the hope is that, they get a taste and they're like, oh, I like this book. I like this series. I like this author. And they jump from series to series. And suddenly, you've got a catalog of 10, 20, 30, 50 books, and people start wading through your entire catalog. And, now you're cooking with gas at that point. It's all getting yourself out there and advertising, professional advertising in one fashion or another seems to be kind of the entry point for that these days. I mean, I think you back me on that, Vincent, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my take is, first of all, I just want to say it like this, what Frank said, you know what I mean? Like Frank hit it on the head when you said like, okay, 95% of my work now is going to be published by Frank Zaffiro Scalise Incorporated. And after this year, I made that same decision. I'm like, okay, enough is enough with all these publishers. I'm going to going forward from 2022 on, unless someone offers me $60,000 or above for one book for a limited amount of time, copyright time, 5 to 7 years, I'm not going to take it. And the only reason at this point I'm even still signing traditional contracts is because you get the trade reviews, and you also get Hollywood attention. Now, I have never had anything produced, but every time I have a traditional book come out, I get some sort of Hollywood attention. That's the only reason. That's it. And I mean, I can tell you, like, I can even dig into the weeds a little bit on this. A lot of it is up to luck. For instance, my first two books were published by Delacorte in a big deal. They assigned me a marketing person, and I even hired the Goldberg firm for $10,000 to try to get it to do something. This was when The Innocent was called As Catch Ken, and it sold like 7,000 copies. It like not even close to me earning out my advance. But then 10 years later, I get the rights back. And, like, this much smaller press puts it out, sells 100,000 copies in, like, 6 weeks. You know, so that's just pure luck. That right there is pure luck. But then you could go, like, you could move on to something like a Thomas and Mercer. I did a bunch of books with them. And, like, the big secret is – well, it's really not a big secret. The reason so many people want to work with them is because they could put your book on the number one Kindle spot overall if they want to. They did it a couple of times for me. And if they decide at a certain point, well, we're not really into them anymore, they can tank your book. And then there's other, and then there were other publishers I worked with, like I'm not going to name names because a couple of them still have my rights, but that just did terrible marketing, terrible editing, and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet they're getting so much praise in Publishers Weekly, and all this sort of stuff. And it makes me turn around and say, like, I mean, I don't mean to be cynical, but I'm like, okay, this was just a rights grab. So that's why, like, at this point, after being in this business 22 years, I'm like, just like Frank said, 95% of my work from now on is going to be independent under my Bear Media label, and that's it.
Yeah, I don't blame you, but I mean, I did go independent. It cost me a fortune, and they did nothing to help me. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, don't work with companies that charge you, friend. That's like vanity.
That's what I didn't know. See, that's what I knew. But decide to do it, I'll let you know. Because
don't
I,
go near them. Yeah, talk to me first because I'll let you know. Yeah.
This one's going to be called Faces Number. My Faces Behind the Stone series, Frank. I write from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone. So it's going to be Faces 8. The last face behind the stone. And
nice.
I think I'm going to talk it from light to dark because this world turned from light to dark. But before I forget, Monday, I'm going to be so brave. Monday, Dr. Maxine Thompson. We're going to talk about her book, Lineage. Maxine is a black author. I love her. She loves me. And she lived with a white family for a year. And she's going to tell her story. And the book is fantastic. On the 26th, hopefully there's no technical problems, the author of Redemptions. On the 28th, Give Me Your Best, Give Me Your Worst. And on the 2nd, I don't know if you're part of this, when we're talking about reviews, I've got 5 people that are brave enough. We're going to talk about what you look for when you're going to rate a book and when you decide to take the book and toss it someplace else. So it's going to be interesting. And on the 4th, Marilyn Levinson is going to be there. And after that, I'm going to be very brave and get my cavity filled, maybe. I don't know. Well, I hate dentists, and I can't be bothered. So in people,
I know, you and I are always at the dentist, Fran.
I know, but this I promised I would do the cavity, but the cavity doesn't mind staying there, so I have to think about it. I don't know. So it's just my warped sense of humor. I can't stand it anymore. Anyway,
oh my God.
If somebody is starting out beforehand in writing, what would you tell them to do? I mean, when I started to write my Bertha series, which I don't know why they don't read sisters, but my sister said, why don't you write about something you know about? I go, well, then you're going to be sorry because I'm writing about you. And then when she died, I wrote Sisters, 2 Sisters from the Bronx. But how do you decide on that first thing? If you're somebody starting to write for the very first time, what do you tell them if they're not sure what to write about? I get emails like that all the time, and I say, write about something you understand that you know about. Don't make up something that, you know, is on the internet or something. Write what you feel passionate about, and then people will read it. And then if you're nice, I might read it also. So what do you tell them when they're first starting out to write?
Frank?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, they say write what you know, and there's
mm-hmm.
some value in that, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
what you know may not be interesting. So if you can't make
yeah.
it interesting, nobody's going to read about it. If what you know is also what you're passionate about, then that's the right combination. I think writing what you're passionate about,
mm-hmm.
writing what you would want to read is where I would start. If this was a young writer who
mm-hmm.
was early in her craft, then I would, you know, plagiarize the hell out of Stephen King and say, read. Because
right.
a good writer has to be a great reader. And to me, reading is like doing push-ups for your writer brain.
You know.
You know, it's just hugely important. And then you got to learn the craft. I mean, you have to be willing to take criticism. And one of the things
mm-hmm.
that I've learned even, you know, decades into my writing career is how to take criticism, and the collaboration process has really helped with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they say, you know, when they talk about cutting things out, they call it kill your darlings, you know, get rid of things
right.
that you love,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they're not important to the story or they're not critical of the story. When you collaborate with somebody, you know, you're not killing your darlings, so someone else is murdering them. And so it gets easy to get, you know, your feelings hurt or whatever, and getting past that and learning how to take constructive criticism, I think is huge. Most people that are taking the time to give you criticism are doing that from a place of, if not love, certainly alliance. They're on your side. I've only very seldom run into people who use the opportunity to give constructive criticism as more of a cudgel or a way to, you know, make themselves, you know, aggrandize themselves a bit. The vast majority of people out there, if they're willing to take a read of your stuff and give you feedback, they're doing it because they're on your side. So even if they say, this part sucks, you need to cut it or you need to change
mm-hmm.
it, then, you know, they're not saying that for any other reason other than it sucks and you need to change it, in their opinion. And listening and figuring out how to take that advice and when not to take the advice, it's a skill. It's a skill you have to develop. And so I tell a new writer, you know, to really work on that skill. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, Vincent, but, like, I mean, you don't take every piece of advice somebody gives you, but you listen to it, right?
Yeah. I have a funny story, anecdotally speaking. When I was in writing school, I had basically, let's see, my senior year, this is what I'm trying to get at. My senior year, I had to come up with a creative thesis, and it had to be 40 plus pages. And it ended up being like the beginning of what would become my first published novel, The Innocent. At the time, they called it As Catch Kent. Anyway, I worked with a guy who was my advisor, like main professor on the thing. And, like, he basically made me cut the crap out of it, right? And at that time, I was really, really, really getting into hard-boiled fiction and thrillers and noir and all this stuff. And that type of material went entirely against the grain of writing school, which was much more esoteric-type stuff, much more literary-type stuff. They have you reading stuff like The Lime Twig, which, like, it is more effective to putting you to sleep than Valium, right?
Mm.
But so, like, you know, I'm not sure they even knew what to make of what I was writing. And so, like, when I got out of writing school, I immediately put all my little darlings back in, totally put everything back in that he suggested I cut, and the book sells for $250,000. And this same professor turns around and says, it's too early for Vince to be published. It's too early. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. So from that point on, I was like, no more writers, no more writing groups, no more workshops, no more anything. I'm going to develop a voice that I can trust, that I like. If I'm having fun writing what I'm doing, then I hopefully the reader will have fun. So, like, to this day, I don't show my work to anybody except my editor, and that's it. You know, and, like, what I write is what I write. And usually it's just one first draft that gets corrected, and then it's out. Now, like, Frank, when you and I work on The Grifters, that'll be different. That's going to be a collaboration. Things got to fit into place. I might not be getting something right or whatever. That's a totally different story. I've also ghosted, you know, like some nonfiction stuff for people or whatever. That's a totally different story. But when it's just me writing what I want to write, how I want to write it, and if it's fun writing it, then it's just going to go out the way it is. And that's what I would suggest to a young writer, like, you know, just like you guys are saying, write whatever you have fun at, you know, like whatever you enjoy watching, whatever you enjoy reading, you know, read a lot of it, watch a lot of it, and then just sort of try to emulate that type of thing.
I agree with you because that's why I like killing people off. I like dead bodies. It's fun. No, actually what happened was my sister died and I went to the cemetery and I still don't know what happened to her that day. And I said, Marcia, if you could tell me what happened to you the day you had a heart attack and why my brother-in-law never called the 911 for 27 minutes, what really happened to you, what would you say? So then I walked around the cemetery and I said, Mr. So-and-so, why are you here? And why are you here? And then I said, wouldn't it be cool to write their stories out of nowhere? And, some people thought it was crazy. And one or two of them, actually, there was a teacher in my school that was wrongly accused and I wrote her story on there. So some of them are based on real-life incidents, and some of them I totally made up because of my warped mind. But the last book I wrote, Population Zero, I gave to Lee Matthew Goldberg. He read it as a favor, and he told me what I had to do to fix it. And I appreciated that because no one wants to read a work of somebody that's not like one of you guys. So it's hard to get somebody to tell me, you know, you screwed that up or that doesn't look right. And I don't get upset with criticism because I appreciate it when it's positive criticism that I can fix. So that to me is no big deal. But basically, you know, when Vincent writes a book, I know I'm in trouble because seriously, I'll read it in an hour and a half and then I'll get nervous and then I'll read it again. I mean, the characters are so evil. But you don't bring anybody back except Chase, right? You're going to bring him back? The Chase series?
Oh, yeah, Chase comes back, yeah. Yep, I have a young Chase series, too. Yep.
This
and Dick Moonlight comes back, and Marconi, all those guys.
This is good.
You
so
both
what's
hit
next
on
for everybody? And what's next for everybody, and when am I getting it so I can put – I can't believe that I've got all the way to April. I've got something.
Frank, what were we going to say?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, between those last three exchanges, what I said, what you said, and then what Fran said, it really distills down what good editing is. And it's beyond just capturing catching, you know, errors and line edits and so forth. But good editing helps bring the writer's voice and intent forward rather than imprinting the editor's voice or intent on the work.
Right.
And I've been fortunate enough to have some good editors over time who understood that and who did that. That's, you know, if you run into somebody who's trying to impose their own ideas on your story or get you to change it the way that they think it should be, that's not editing. That's a hostile takeover. So learning when to take advice and when to ignore it, like you're talking about, I think that's a huge thing for young writers.
Yep.
So, you know.
It's so very true because no two people have – I was just going to say no two people have the same aesthetic. And my last book with Thomas and Mercer, I had a run-in with the editor because she was totally taking the novel over. Totally taking it over.
Gone.
And I'm like, this isn't even my novel anymore. So I want to get the rights back to it and put it out the way I originally envisioned it. Anyway, I'm sorry. I'm just saying.
No, but there are several kinds of editors I learned. But, you know, the hardest one is when they correct spelling and grammar and they screwed up and don't get everything.
Yeah.
So my very first book, My Name is Bertha, I went to whatever publishing company and I asked them to edit it. And it was a good thing my sister read it over and my mother-in-law was an editor. But when I sent him the final galley that had no mistakes, they printed it with the mistakes. So they emailed me and they said, well, now you have to pay to get this done over. I said, that's not going to happen. It may be my first book, but I'm not stupid. And I refused to pay them to do it. I said, you will do it over because that's not what I sent you. And I read books by famous authors. I just read one, and I said, oh, on page 365, she's got a typo. You know, I don't tell them. When I write a review, I don't say anything. And I just read a children's book, and I read some of the reviews after I posted mine, and they slammed her because they said she had spelling and grammar errors. And I said, well, maybe she was the kid that wrote the book. You know what? It didn't take away from it. It didn't matter. So what? I don't know. Maybe that's me. That's what we're going to talk about on November 2nd, is how do you decide whether a book is poorly edited? How do you decide when you review a book if the book is worthy of 3 stars, 4 stars, 5 stars, or worthy of not reviewing at all? Or do you review a book and give a negative review, which is something that I won't do ever? Because I won't pan somebody's work because I might hate it, but somebody else might love it. Seriously. So, Frank, what's next for you, and when am I getting something to read that's good? Because I've got a pile inside that's interestingly boring.
Interestingly boring.
My doctor was online with this girl. She's a New York Times author. He called me up first Saturday. He said, first I'm going to tell you your test results are good. I go, I don't care about that. Why are you calling me? He said, because I met this author, a New York Times author, online in the bank, and she wrote this book, and she would like you to read it. I go, gee, thank you very much. Are you going to read it also? I am reading it. It's very sad, though. It's very good, but it's very sad. I said, now he's promoting authors, too. So what are you doing next, and when am I getting it?
Well, I mentioned at the top of the show that I write in a lot of different series, and so I've got a book lined up. In 3 of the different series. The next one coming out in the River City series, it's called Dirty Little Town.
Nice.
It's the 7th book in the series. That will be out November 18th.
I can send you
an arc of that as soon as I'm comfortable. I've got all the mistakes out. And
if it's large print, it'll be even better.
Well, it'll be... digital, you can make the print as big as you want. I wrote a series with Colin Conway called the Charlie 316 series, which was a 4-book arc, a police procedural, with very, very interconnected story. And now that that arc is over, we've decided to continue to set books in that series, but the books won't be a direct sequel to the 4-book arc. It'll just be, you know, it'll happen after that, and it'll be in the same world, but it's, you know, not necessarily a direct sequel. And so I'm working on one called The Ride Along that'll be out in a few months in that series. And right now I'm working on the 3rd book in my Spokompton series, which is a series that, you know, I write gritty crime fiction from both sides of the badge. This is from the underside of the badge. This is from the criminal side of things.
I love that.
Though
the
bad guys are
book.
Featured. So.
That is good. And Vince, what do you
want?
Well, besides Desperate Marriage and The Teacher, what else is coming out that I should put in my schedule? I'm serious. It needs a little adrenaline. Seriously.
It's coming. I'm trying to put out at least a short story a week right now. Desperate Measures, the collection just came out. I'll get you a copy of that. When I go to Europe, I'm going to write my episode in the Grifter series and Frank's Grifter series, so that'll be exciting. I got The Slender Man is coming out. That's a Jack Marconi PI. I got The Dam's coming out. That's a Jack Marconi PI. These are novels. I got another Steve Jobs, The Plumber, that's coming out. I've got Young Chase Baker and The Well of the Soul, that's coming out. I've got The Extractors, which is a brand new series, the first one of those. I've got American Crimes, which I'm actually putting up for free on Substack right now. I just started today. I've got, as you know, Paradox Lake just came out from Ocean View, and Her Darkest Secrets coming out from Suspense next year, and I have Moonlight Kills. Don and Al's going to do Moonlight Kills, and another standalone called The Sleeper right now. I'm not sure if I'm going to keep that title. And I'm working on this thing called The Teacher. So, like, I got more going than I can keep track of.
I should just put you in every single month or something. So,
yeah,
where can we besides Amazon and Barnes and Noble and everywhere, is there anybody special place special that you want people to buy your stuff? Because if they don't, they're out of their minds. Because seriously, no, I'm reading a book about Guatemala. It's interesting. It just gets
love Guatemala.
Too much. Yeah. It's good about Guatemala. The author wrote about it. It's Paul and Diana. Paul and Carol go to Guatemala. It's interesting. It's just that there's too much Guatemala in it, not enough Paul and Carol, but it's interesting. The book I was talking about before is called Lizzie and Dante. It's very sad, but it's really good, by Mary Bly. So those two are okay, and then there's the rest of them that are inside that are staring at me and say, when are you going to get to me? I said, as soon as I get the energy to read it. But I will, but eventually. So where can we find out about all of your books?
Frank?
Besides Amazon and Barnes and Noble.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest place to find out anything is frankzafiro.com. And Zafiro
okay.
is Z-A-F-I-R-O. Frankzafiro.com. I've got all the books, all the stories, the podcast, the link to the podcast, Wrong Place, Right Crime is there as well. And then the people can sign up for my newsletter. And that's always a good way to know when the new releases are coming out and so forth. I would say if you're going to buy a hard copy of the book, I don't care where you buy it. If you prioritize your local bookstore first, every community has one somewhere, thankfully. I don't know how long that's going to last, but they still do. And, buy it there. Buy local if you can. I think that's a great policy. But the majority of my sales, quite honestly, are through Kindle. So I one thing I don't think people think about very often that I wish they would realize and be more willing to do is, you don't have to apologize if you use the library to read any of our books,
right.
Because if you go to the library and say, hey, I want to read this new book, Dirty Little Town just came out, I want to read it, will you buy it? The library almost certainly, if you request it, is going to say sure. And they're going to buy a hard copy of the book, and then you get to read it. So does everybody else. When it gets worn out, they're going to replace it.
Right.
And, writers benefit from that. So sometimes people apologize. Oh, I read your book, but I got it from the library.
No,
don't
my husband
apologize.
Reads
You're
only library
me
books.
Out.
My husband reads only library books. So I said to him, would you like me to buy you one? No, that's why we have the library. So he orders something every week, and he reads stuff like what Vincent writes, too. I'm just trying to get him to read Vincent so he could appreciate it. So, Vincent, where would you say, besides, the library is a good place, but Fran reads, they send me the book, so what? I don't have to bother with that. It's great. And as long as they send it to me in print, what about you?
Just like Frank, just go to vinzandry.com, vinzandry.com, or, or Google Vincent Zandry or Vince Zandry or whatever, and you'll find everything you need. It'll lead you to my website. And just like Frank, everything's there. All the bookstores, all the, the podcast, all that sort of stuff. And, actually, what's funny? You were talking about libraries. I actually go to this one dive bar. You would never know it. Motorcycles outside and all that sort of stuff. And they have a terrific lending library, and I give them so many free books, it's ridiculous. And like I'll walk in and some dude clad in leather will be like, oh, I love the new Marconi, man. And it's the funniest thing, you just wouldn't expect some of these guys to be really into their reading, but they are.
Yeah, there's a bunch of those lending libraries around my neighborhood, and I anything within walking distance, I keep it stocked.
That's a great idea.
It's a good idea, and it's a good way for people to discover you,
Sure.
We don't have that around
yep.
here. As a matter of fact, they just started to let people come in to get books, just to look around. And like I said, people just send them to me. It makes it so much easier than to worrying about it. and as long as they send me print. The one or two publishing companies are not doing print, and unfortunately, because I agreed to interview the author, I got stuck sending it to my pals at FedEx, and they will print anything I want because they love me.
Right.
And I get.
I'm like Frank though. I'm the majority of my sales are e-books.
I can't read on my phone. It bothers my eyes, besides the fact that I have to take notes, mark it up, and circle and write the questions in the book as I'm doing it. And then I read like about 5 or 6 a week, and that's a slow week.
Wow.
When I was growing up, I used to read 10 because my mother said, oh, God, reading. Reading is such power. But before we end, I say this at the end of every one of my shows. If everybody in the world would say something kind and do something wonderful for other people, that would be so great, because the kindness is a good way to tell this horrible pandemic that you're negative and we don't want you here anymore. Maybe you'll leave and stop taking lives. It just bothers me. And yesterday we lost Colin Powell, and that really bothered me a lot because he was such a good person and he died of COVID. So maybe this, if everybody started to realize that we're in a world together and it's not so bad, maybe if you started appreciating everybody, maybe this horrible COVID thing would just disappear and say, I'm not welcome here because I'm negative. But I want to thank you both. This has been fun. You brightened my morning.
Thank you.
Everybody, have a great day. The sun is shining. Have a great day. Stay positive, and bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, guys.
Bye.